House Committee on Judiciary, come to order. Today is Wednesday, April 29th. The first item we're going to go to on the agenda today is open a public hearing and a possible work session on Senate Bill 233.
Senate Bill 233 creates the statutory framework for victims to exercise their constitutional rights set forth in Section 42 and 43 of Article 1 in the Constitution of the State of Oregon. It grants the Attorney General the authority to adopt rules to establish a non-judicial process to determine if violations have occurred and to make non-binding recommendations for achieving full compliance with victims' rights laws in the future. Clarifies when the District Attorney and when the Probation Department will notify a victim of a probation hearing. We have the fiscal statement should be in front of each committee member. It's indeterminate, and there's no revenue impact.
Could I have the Mr. Attorney General, Steve Dole, and Doug Baloof first, please? Please go ahead. Just identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. Members of the committee, I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 233. As the committee is aware, we have modified the Oregon Constitution as of 2008 in order to give standing to crime victims to assert rights that they've been previously given to be able to participate more fully in the criminal process. We now need to have a statutory framework for how those rights are going to be treated in the courtroom and how claims that those rights have been violated are going to be properly adjudicated, both at the trial level and at the appellate level. And that's what this legislation does. I won't try to make a summary of all the provisions, but I think three aspects are of particular note. First, the bill gives us a process to allow crime victims to be heard at critical stages of the proceedings, before we have a pretrial release, at a time at which a plea may be taken for violent felony cases, and at sentencing. Second, it gives us a process for adjudication of claims by a crime victim that the rights have been violated, and that framework is necessary in order to have an orderly manner of considering these issues. And finally, it establishes a similar process for appellate review of determinations about crime victims' rights at the trial level. This is an extraordinarily important step for the state to take. Previously, we'd given rights, but people had no real practical way to assert those rights, and thus the possession of those rights was somewhat hollow. This gives real force to the constitutional rights that crime victims have been granted, and we would urge the passage of the bill. I'd be happy at the end of the testimony of my fellow panel members to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole with Crime Victims United of Oregon. It is fitting that we have this hearing today on Senate Bill 233, this being, as all of you know, National Crime Victims Week, and we're in the middle of that week. And so it is an honor to be here today, and I'm very happy to have the support of the Attorney General. This bill was, as you know, up in front of the legislature during the special session, did not pass then, but we ultimately have gotten a better bill out of it, and we have not only the support of the former Attorney General, Hardy Myers, but now our new Attorney General, John Kroger, and we thank Mr. Kroger very much for that support. This is a culmination of 25 years of work in Oregon. And as far as Crime Victims United goes, it's really a legacy for us. In 1984, we placed the first Crime Victims Bill of Rights initiative on the ballot. It failed. In 1986, it was followed up, and it was overwhelmingly passed by the people. However, it was a statutory piece, not a constitutional piece. In 1992, we failed to make the ballot with a constitutional piece, but came back in 1996 and passed Measure 40. It was subsequently found unconstitutional by the courts in 1998 on technicality, not on the substance, and was brought back and repassed through the legislature in seven separate pieces in 1999 and referred to the people, and four of those seven pieces were passed by the people. Last year in May, as Attorney General Kroger mentioned, measures 51 and 52 were passed, which removed the bar and gives crime victims now the ability to seek remedies when their rights are violated. We did not have that before. We were one of only two states in the union that did not have that, ourselves in Virginia. So we're grateful to the people of Oregon for the passage of those two measures. And this bill merely sets the framework for this these measures to be operational. Once again, we want to thank you very much for hearing the bill, and we ask you to pass it on to the floor for a vote. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
My name is Doug Ballouf. I'm a professor of law at Lewis and Clark College, and what I first want to emphasize to the committee is that all constituency groups were deeply involved for 2 years in the formulation of this criminal procedure. The courts, the prosecutors, crime victims groups, the attorney general, criminal defense lawyers, trial courts, parole and probation, and appellate court interests were looked at. This is a bill that is will be the most coherent set of procedures for enforcing victims' rights in the trial courts and in appellate courts in the entire nation once it is passed by this legislature. And what it does is it is an effort to render these procedures efficient. That is, to try to push resolution of these matters into the trial courts and for there not to be appellate litigation unless that litigation is absolutely essential. It is the subject of many, many sessions, half-day sessions, of meeting with the various attorneys and agencies interested over a period of a very long time. So I urge you to pass it. I'm happy to answer any questions about any specific aspect of it, but understand that each aspect of it is delicately balanced with other aspects of it. In terms of how this group of people working together came to support the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm John Stein with the International Organization for Victim Assistance. Let me just comment first on Doug's point, perspective. The process that this was created was remarkable. I've spent all my legislative career up to a couple years ago in Washington, D.C. And the idea that you had the ACLU, the prosecutors, the judiciary sitting at the table working it out in harmony was a unique and wonderful experience for me. Chair Barker was often there, and it was very long. It was an extraordinary thing. It's a great testament to the political and legal culture of the state. Very thoughtful people working out a lot of detail in the development of this bill. There are three things I would stress. First is, Doug is halfway right. It is the most rigorous set of procedures to make clear victim rights and how you get them enforced in the country. But we, in my travels with my friends in the international community who are pursuing all the same goals, they too regard it as the model. So Oregon leads the nation and the world when this becomes law, and that makes me very proud. Second, one unique feature about it is it drives, as Doug indicated, it drives most of the decision-making, most of the complaint down at the trial level. Forces the judges and the prosecutors to police their own behavior, to be checking in with the victim to see if the rights have been honored as it go along. And it opens the door for victims to squawk any time and have a simple, clear way of getting that complaint resolved. It's wonderful in its expectation of getting it fixed at the front end without need for appeal. The third thing is, and Chair Barker, you may recall this, it is a complicated bill necessarily with lots of concerns about procedures, but built in throughout was an effort to figure out a way, what can the victim do on his or her own to see that his or her rights are being honored? But the opportunities for pro se advocacy to protect your rights is built into this, and I think it's a wonderful feature. There will be a user's guide, a user's manual for this bill when it comes law, for any crime victim to understand their rights and hold on to them. With that, I do hope the committee passes on it favorably and the legislature puts it in law. Thank you.
Questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Pat Schreiner, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Pat Schreiner. I'm a district manager with Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 233, on behalf of Multnomah County Department of Community Justice and the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. This bill creates procedures for victims to assert their constitutional rights in criminal and juvenile delinquency procedures. Our piece of it, community corrections piece of it, is small, and really my testimony is simply to show the collaboration and the cooperation of the groups coming together. And so for community corrections, we agree that we are going to work in collaboration with the courts and the district attorneys to provide notification to victims on cases in which we initiate a request with the court for a probation violation hearing or a revocation hearing. And that is our piece. As the other members mentioned, this is a comprehensive and actually somewhat complicated bill, but that's our piece, and that's how we have joined in support. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Elizabeth Kushwa, please.
Committee, good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Kushwa, here for the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of Senate Bill 233. The ODAA, specifically Rod Underhill from Multnomah County, participated in the work group with Steve Dole, Doug Maloof, and the Department of Justice. We are very confident that all of our concerns have been met in the bill, and we really look forward to a smooth implementation of the initiatives passed in 2008.
Okay, any questions, Ms. Kushwa? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I would close the hearing, or carry this bill over till tomorrow, and close hearing today. And the reason for that committee is there. It says there's a Ways and Means referral that I don't believe is necessary, but we'll take a quick look at that. I'll be back tomorrow. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 212.
Senate Bill 212 rewrites criteria for programs distributing victim assistance funds to city and county offices for victim services, adds the requirement that notice be given to victims of their rights as soon as practical, declares an emergency, it's effective upon passage. This had no fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Okay. Cynthia Stinson and Deborah Bridges, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division with the Oregon Department of Justice. And I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 212 and Senate Bill 218. If I could, I'd like to just give you an overview of our division so you have context for these two bills. The division is made up of three primary sections. One is our crime victims compensation section. We provide reimbursement to individual victims of violent persons crimes for crime-related injuries, so for child sex abuse, domestic violence, sexual assault, homicide, and other assaults. We provide some reimbursement to victims of crime after any other insurance or Oregon Health Plan has paid. We ought to have a victim response section, and that the bulk of the work of that section is to administer six state and federal grants, including the Federal Victim of Crime Act grant, the Federal Violence Against Women Act grant, the state general-funded Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, and also the criminal fine assessment account grants to the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Programs and to the victim assistance programs throughout the state. Our third section is our victims' rights section, and as you just heard in testimony 233, the activities of the passage of the constitutional amendments and hopefully the passage of the implementation legislation in 233 will keep that section busy for quite some time, making sure that victims know what their rights are and working with all the stakeholders in the system to get that implemented smoothly. So if I may begin with 212, this legislation is a collaboration between Department of Justice and the victim assistance programs in the district attorney's offices and also has the support of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. This statute has been in place for quite some time, and we realized that the changing practice at the victim assistance programs, we really needed to clarify and update the statute, especially in light of the passage of the constitutional amendments and the increased responsibilities of the victim assistance programs in the DA's offices to make notification to victims. One of the requirements for receiving this CFAA funding for our office will now be notification of victims' rights. That only made sense to us. So most of the bill is updating. There's some antiquated language that I'm not sure anybody really understood what it meant. So we clarified that. We also wanted to reflect again, the increased responsibility to these programs. There's language in the statute that talks about a comprehensive victim services program, and it implies that the funding that's received through the CFAA would allow district attorney's offices to create a comprehensive program. In light of the economic realities of the funding that is received to go to those programs, we thought it was more appropriate that we focus on core services being provided with this funding rather than comprehensive, which was undefined and probably not a fair expectation. So I'm happy to answer any questions. Really, it is a modification to keep up with the changing practices at the victim assistance programs.
Questions? Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Bridges, and I'm the director of the Yamhill County Crime Victims Office. I'm also the president of the Oregon Crime Victims Assistance Network. I and colleagues around the state were very active with the work of this committee, and I'm here to support it. We're very happy to have the language in a way that makes sense to us. It also helps our victims understand what their expectations for services from the crime victims' offices are, and I just want to add my support to this. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Shall I move on to 218? Oh, excuse me.
Go ahead and start with 218.
Sure.
Yeah. I'll close the public hearing on House on Senate Bill 212. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 218.
And Senate Bill 218 increases the eligibility and award amounts for crime victims' compensation, increases claim time frame for homicide from 3 to 5 years, adds a benefit for victims whose offenders are moving through a pilot process from parole board hearings, removes the prohibition on compensation for those living with or related to the perpetrator. And again, this bill has a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 218. This bill has some technical fixes in it, but there are four significant pieces I want to point out to you. The first is it extends the duration of an open claim in cases of homicide from 3 to 5 years. Currently, a claim, once it is opened and accepted in our office, it has a 3-year duration. And so, as you probably know, with homicide cases, it's possible for the claim to be opened and closed before the case even goes to trial. And as you might imagine, the families really need continued support, usually through counseling, reimbursement of counseling costs that after the trial. So this is an effort. This is a request by Crime Victims United, and And I think it's a valid concern to be able to offer some more access to counseling and other benefits to these homicide survivor families. Another benefit that we will be offering through this bill is to allow victims whose offenders are engaged in the appellate or other collateral processes to apply for limited counseling and some inappropriate transportation and lodging benefits, again, reimbursement-based. And it will also allow victims whose offenders are required to appear before the parole board those same limited counseling and transportation and lodging benefits. And these two groups of victims have been largely forgotten in our system. This is one way that we're trying to start to reach out to these kind of populations of victims. They get services and have access to compensation benefits when the crime originally occurs, but in the appellate and the parole board processes, those take place often years and years, sometimes 20-25 years after the original crime, and can be very traumatic for those victims having to hear details again of the crime or hear the offender go before the parole board and speak about the crime. So again, these are limited benefits. That's why we have a minimal fiscal on this. People do take advantage of counseling, but often they don't go forever, so they need limited support, but it is very significant for them when they need it. The final change, I just point out to you because most folks aren't sure what it means. I just want to clarify, it's in the very last part of the bill. When our program was created in 1977, part of the statute was that if a victim was living with or related to their offender, they were not eligible for crime victims' compensation benefits. And I think it was a reflection of what we knew about victimization at the time. What we know now, and what probably all of you know and is obvious to you, is that unfortunately it's those that we live with and are related to that hurt us most often. And so the majority of victims are victimized by someone they live with or know. That statute was changed at one point to include those victims, but it was not made retroactive. So this will include and affect a very, very small group of victims. But there are some victims that are coming forward now that are reporting abuse as children and wanting to move forward with prosecution and cooperating with prosecution. And it's very difficult for them to apply for our program and realize that we basically tell them they're not a victim. So it's as long as we were making some changes to the statute, I thought I would rectify that error.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Representative Shields.
I'm very supportive of the policy in all of this, Ms. Stinson. I'm trying to figure out how, though, we could expand the number of things that people could be reimbursable for, and yet they're not be any fiscal impact whatsoever. Could you help me understand that?
Yes. I'm Chair Barker, Representative Shields. Good question. When we started looking at these benefits, we took a look at, on average, how long victims right after a crime go to counseling. And on average, I mean, there are some people that go much longer than others, but on average, it's about 10 to 15 times they go to counseling. So for these victims in the appellate and collateral processes and going before the parole board, we estimated they would probably only go two or three times, if needed, to some counseling, specifically around that hearing or around that parole board process. So it's very minimal. And again, it's a reimbursement basis. So if they have insurance has to pay first. So, for example, if you have a $20 copay, we might be paying the $20 copay. We wouldn't be paying the full $85 charge for the counselor. So that's how we thought it would be minimal. There are folks that won't take advantage of this at all, and the volume of victims going through the appellate and collateral processes and the parole board process is much smaller than the victims currently being victimized at this time.
So counseling, that makes sense. Do you have a sense of how many, what was your estimation of how many people would be maybe attending parole board hearings that might not otherwise? It seems like the lodging and might be considerable. Or do you have a sense of, or did you tell LFO how many people you anticipated would take advantage of that?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, we actually did not. I don't anticipate it will be significant. We have the ability to make administrative rules around how much we allow, and we would be working with that to make sure that the impact was minimal. Our hope is that there might be some folks that absolutely could not participate in the process because they can't pay the gas to get here, and they can't, you know, they need one night stay in a hotel. Since those hearings usually aren't multiple day hearings, we're hopeful that it will be minimal.
And then the last thing is they generally take place in Salem, correct?
Yes, so. Chair Barker, Representative Shields, they generally take place in Salem.
So it would be follow-up if I could. So probably, I mean, if you're from a metropolitan area, the expenses probably wouldn't be overnight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm also, I'm Deborah Bridges with the Yamhill County Crime Victims Office and president of the Crime Victims Assistance Network, and I am also here on behalf of my colleagues around the state. All of us who work with crime victims who are impacted by homicide, it is not uncommon for us to have the District Attorney's Victims Office to have contact with those families well past the three-year time. And right after a homicide, they are in life-sustaining mode. They are trying to get through their life on a day-to-day measure. And thinking about their own counseling may not be a top priority. So the extension of these benefits is vital, I feel. And in working with the families that I've worked with over the last 5 years, I can see why this will be very important for us. Also, the appellate and parole board hearings, we work with those victims as well. And it is, the first one I attended was with a young woman. She was 23 and her mother was killed murdered in front of her when she was 5. And I think that's kind of what the age range was. Anyway, it's the first time she had seen her father who had killed her mother. And it was so traumatizing for her to go down to the bowels of whatever prison that was we were in. He was basically in this cage. It was very scary for her to see him for the first time. She had no counseling. She had no opportunity to have finances to help pay for that. She really needed it. And those are examples of people who will utilize these services, hopefully. So to have them available is very important. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Any questions?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
I was ready.
I'll start with this man with this. We'll go to work session. This one will go back. Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 218.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westnap.
Would it be convenient for the committee to stand at ease for a moment?
Yes.
Thank you.
on Senate Bill 218 and open a work session on Senate Bill 212.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 212 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 212 to the floor of a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative
Cameron? Yes.
Representative Barrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Really discuss.
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stegner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Chair Barkley?
Aye.
Motion carries.
He just voted for it.
You want to? Sure. Representative Stegner will be the courier. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 92. No, we shut 218. We're holding it for a day or so.
Okay, 92, sorry for that.
Yeah, who's up for that?
Senate Bill 92 allows the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to conduct research to improve police, fire, corrections, parole, probation, emergency medical dispatch, and telecommunications professional services. This bill has no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Eric Gavlitz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Parker, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Skablix, Deputy Director for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. This is a bill that would allow the department to conduct research. Currently, our language states that we can stimulate research, but not actively or individually conduct it, and that's what the change in front of you is today, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Ridiculous. So it allows you to research in police training matters?
Chair Barker, it would really in public safety in general. Right now, what has happened is organizations approach us and ask if we're interested in participating, and usually the answer is yes, unless there's a large fiscal impact on our end. But as many of you know, you visit our campus. We do a lot of different types of training, which really is of interest to whether it's injury prevention, vehicle dynamics, for example, for police cars, and those type of things. But we can't actively request to be partners. We have to wait for someone to call us. So this will allow us to basically open up the door.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for the panel? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gavlix, why has this ever existed? I mean, why wouldn't you be able to go out there and do that right now? That seems strange.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, right now what has happened is that we have basically participated in research done by other organizations. We've never done any of our own independent research. One of the things that we're seeing more and more are a number of grants coming out from the federal government public safety areas where they're looking for research-based studies, whether it's for 911 operators, firefighters. A number of our other state partners in other states have actually participated in that through their academy setting, but we currently, with the statute, don't have the ability to do that because we can't conduct our own research. We have to wait for someone to ask us to participate.
Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just remember that Director Minnis was really instrumental in trying to get this body to have better evidence basis for a lot of its decisions around crime and delinquency. He helped pioneer the idea of having a criminal justice and or crime and delinquency policy institute. I assume part of that is his interest. Part of this is his interest in making sure that when we try things, we evaluate them to see how they work. And I think particularly in the public safety subcommittee, we've been pushing the department to come back with key performance measures, particularly around training and the effects of it. So you know, we're going to go to 16 weeks, and then you know, what's in my district? You know, what does that mean to the average citizen? Are there fewer use of force incidents, those kinds of things? A lot of questions we ask that I think they want to answer, and it seems like this would give you the opportunity to do so, and I would be very supportive.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 92.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 92 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 92 to the floor of the due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Shields, you made a good point there when you carried that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 99.
Senate Bill 99 authorizes a probation officer to test a person on probation with a history of drug or alcohol abuse for the presence of those substances in the person's system by a method that includes a blood test or any other method of testing, which would also include the currently allowed methods of testing the breath or urine. This has no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Pat Schreiner and Mark Cadote. I'm sure I said that wrong.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mark Cadot, and I'm the Community Corrections Director for the State of Oregon Department of Corrections. And as counsel has stated, Senate Bill 99 is a pretty straightforward bill that would allow for a variety of new drug testing, drug and alcohol testing procedures that are now in place. The current statute limits the testing to breath and urine testing, and we have several new technologies that are available to parole and probation officers for testing that we'd like to be included. So what the bill does is simply modify the language in Oregon Revised Statute 137.540 to delete the reference to breath and urine testing and just modify the language to submit to testing for controlled substances for drug and alcohol use. And that's the essence of the bill. There is no fiscal, and I urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very supportive of that. I think this is a key way of keeping offenders accountable and keeping them clean and sober, keeping their hand out of the cookie jar, if you will, if they know that they're going to have to report and give a specimen. I am just curious, though, what an electronic band test is.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields. It's actually a band that an offender wears around their ankle, similar to a home detention bracelet, that through transepidermal transmission can detect the use of, it's limited to alcohol at this point, but in doing some research, I've also understood that they're soon to come out with a transepidermal test that would test for opiates, cocaine, and methamphetamine as well. And it can actually provide live data back to the computer main station or download into the computer for subsequent testing.
Well, yeah, sounds like a good idea.
Further questions? Okay, thank you. Pat?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Pat Schreiner again on behalf of, I'm a district manager in Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm testifying in support of this bill on behalf of not only Multnomah County, but also the Association of Oregon Community Corrections Directors. Before I get started, I've got two bills that I have written testimony on, and I want to actually apologize to Vice Chair Stiegler because in my written testimony I have an error. It's my first time in front of the committee this year, and I didn't catch the error. So if you'll forgive me for that, and I'll...
Did you misspell my name?
Yeah, I sure did. So actually... Mark Cadot covered most of the key issues there. The other, one other key advantage I would point out is that one of the sometimes obstacles for parole and probation officers to test the people they're supervising is the fact that males have to test males, females have to test females with urine testing. So these other methodologies allow us a lot greater flexibility. You know, particularly when parole and probation officers are also making home visits out in the field, and so it really makes sense to go this way. Other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, further questions?
And you're not the first one, nor the last.
Thank you. Close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 99.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 99 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 99 to the floor of the due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett. Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. You want that one on the consent calendar?
Sure.
Okay. It'll be on the consent calendar. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 100.
Senate Bill 100 requires the Department of Corrections, beginning in 2012 and every 6 years thereafter, to conduct a study to determine the actual costs incurred by each county in providing management, support services, supervision, and sanctioning of felons under the supervision of the county. It has a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued and no revenue impact.
Ginger Martin, Pat Schreiner, and Paul Snyder, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I am Ginger Martin, an assistant director with the Department of Corrections responsible for the Transitional Services Division, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 100. Senate Bill 100 requires the department to conduct a cost study for community corrections beginning in 2012 and then again every 6 years thereafter. The bill was written to carry out recommendations of the Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services. The cost study is necessary to provide us the information to assure that state payments for community corrections keep pace with actual costs of carrying out that particular responsibility. If state payments don't keep pace with actual costs, then the ability of community corrections to manage offenders is compromised, or counties will be compelled to pick up those additional costs. We did conduct a cost study of the kind envisioned in the statute in 2006. There currently is not statute that requires us to do it. The reason for proposing statute is to assure that this commitment continues with new leadership at the Department of Corrections. We can do this and did do this with existing resources, and I'll close by urging your support for Senate Bill 100.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Pat Schreiner with Multnomah County again, testifying on behalf of Multnomah County Department of Community Justice and the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors on behalf of Senate Bill 100. As Ginger Martin stated, this bill would endorse the cost study for community corrections beginning in 2012 and for this study to be done every 6 years from that date. You received a Department of Corrections briefing on this paper, on this bill to you, and it indicated that the counties are impacted by the loss of federal forest revenue. It is vital that the actual cost of community corrections services and sanctions are captured and funded accordingly. This is also true in communities where the kinds of revenue are in flux, as in the case in Multnomah County. As a district manager in the largest community corrections department in the state, my department and county support this bill for a number of important reasons. One, it creates the proven and accurate, transparent funding model that works for the state and works for the counties. The 2005-2007 legislatively adopted budget for community corrections implemented the actual cost model developed by Department of Corrections in partnership with the counties. The process worked. It worked well, and we should use this process again. It is a simpler way of predicting planning for the most effective supervision. The process will establish a simple per-offender cost for supervision, correctional treatment programs and services, and community-based sanctions necessary to manage parole and probation offenders. Having a predictable sense of what we can spend on offenders will help us manage these offenders more effectively. Third, it helps to support a cost-effective system of holding offenders accountable. At a time when the state cannot afford the prisons and jails it has, Senate Bill 100 helps us predictably fund a more effective, less expensive form of supervision for the right offenders. Community supervision costs about one-eighth, about $9.95 a day, what it costs to imprison someone, which is about $77.78. And finally, it helps to support an effective public safety investment. Over 70% of Oregon's 34,000 felons under parole and post-prison supervision do not reoffend within 3 years. Thank you for the time. I would urge you also to support this and pass this bill and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Paul? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. As Ginger Martin mentioned to you already, this is one of several recommendations from the Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services, which was created to address the issues of severe declines in county forest revenues that occurred over the last several years. There are 54 recommendations that came forward from that task force. This is one of them. As a matter of fact, SJM 12 is another one, and that will come before the committee in just another few minutes, I hope. We recommend that the committee endorse and move Senate Bill 100 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Representative Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Panel, I'm just curious, why did the committee recommend to wait till 2012? I'm just thinking, Mr. Chair, if this is a good thing to do, why are we waiting 2 more years?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, we actually did conduct a cost study in 2006, and so 2012 would mark the 6-year mark from the last one.
Okay. Representative Westham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Martin, first, didn't the Criminal Justice Commission, aren't we looking to them in the past for cost of imprisonment and everything, and is this a mission they should have versus DOC?
Representative Barker, Representative Wisnett, I don't think that the Criminal Justice Commission actually creates the cost basis. They do help estimate numbers of offenders who may come into prison, leave prison, come into supervision in the community and leave. But it's the Department of Corrections that actually assigns the case costs, if you will, to create the fiscal.
Another question, Mr. Chair.
Please, follow up.
Mr. Snyder, so the counties are going to be, you know, looking at this information, and I guess the question is, versus having a Criminal Justice Commission, which is independent, versus DOC provide the data, and could you comment on that and the 6 years? Is the price going to, you know, change so much that it's going to make it impossible for the counties to continue to support this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, we're confident in the ability of the department to put the numbers together because we work cooperatively with the department, as does the Community Corrections Directors Association. Last time we did this, which I think is a good template for future cost studies, a group was created by the department, including a good cross-section of all three organizations, plus I think representation from other agencies as well. And we sent the surveys out. We surveyed each of the sheriffs on jail costs. We surveyed each of the community corrections departments on community corrections costs. It was a pretty elaborate procedure, which is another reason why we don't want to do it more than once every 6 years, because it's rather labor-intensive on the part of the counties and the department. So we're confident that the results will be an accurate reflection of the actual costs, and it's a lot more in-depth than the kind of work that the Criminal Justice Commission does or could be expected to do. In fact, I think the numbers that the Criminal Justice Commission uses come from the department.
Clarification, Mr.
Clarification, please.
Thank you. So, Mr. Snyder, you're saying that the counties are okay with this every 6 years. They're not going to be coming out based upon price increases ever.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, we prefer that the cost kept pace every biennium, but we recognize that that's a very difficult thing to pull off, both in terms of the economic environment today and in terms of the amount of work it takes to identify those costs. Within 6 years, I don't think we'll get too far afield of what the actual costs are.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Yeah. Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 100.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move Senate Bill 100 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 100 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
I can do it too.
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Yes.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Excused.
Vice Chair Wisnet?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries.
Wayne can do it either.
Representative Krieger, carry the bill, please. Representative Shields, would you like to vote on Senate Bill 100?
Yes, aye.
Okay, Representative Shields votes aye. And I'm going to briefly reopen Senate Bill 218 to announce we're carrying that over to Monday, the 4th of May. And also, close that, reopen Senate Bill 233A and move it till Monday the 4th as well to give us time to check that. Okay. Krieger.
Okay. The bill's here.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Next item on the agenda is Senate Joint Memorial 12. Open a public hearing. And Mr. Taylor will explain it here momentarily.
Chairman of the Committee, SJM 12 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary. It petitions Congress to enact tax refund intercept legislation permitting Oregon to obtain tax refund of persons who owe Oregon tax court-ordered financial obligations. It's estimated that we could collect as much as $60 million. It's about $1 billion.
Mr. Lemon and Mr. Snyder, please.
$60 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Phil Lemon from the Judicial Department. I'm here representing Chief Justice Paul DeMunis. He's out of town and not able to be here today, but asked me to convey his support for this memorial. In addition, Mr. O'Leary could not be here today from the governor's office, but the governor also supports this. The Judicial Department is seeking authority both at the state and federal level so we can intercept federal tax refunds in order to collect financial obligations imposed by state courts. This includes victim restitution, fines, fees, and penalties owed to the state as a result of those actions. We currently are able to intercept state tax refunds to collect these judgments. We use federal, the state of Oregon is able to attach federal tax refunds for child support, uncollected state tax debt, and others. So we are trying to get your support for this concept. You will have the opportunity to look at substantive legislation to implement this at a later date. Senate Bill 93 is now in the public safety sub in Ways and Means, and we look forward to an early hearing on that. So the details of this will be coming to you later, but we're asking for your support for this concept. The concept has received bipartisan support from the Oregon delegation in the last Congress. Their legislation is being introduced this time around, and so we're just trying to keep the ball rolling here.
Thank you. Mr. Snyder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and urge support for SJM 12. This is another recommendation from the Governor's Task Force, which we described earlier this afternoon. It's intended to increase the collection capacity of the Judicial Department and those folks to whom these obligations are owed. We'd urge the committee to endorse SJM 12.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Joint Memorial 12.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnet.
I move Senate Joint Memorial 12 to the floor and do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnet moves Senate Joint Memorial 12 to the floor to do pass. Any questions? Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Barton? Aye. Representative Cameron? Aye.
Representative Garrett? Aye. Representative Krieger? Aye.
Representative Olson? Aye. Representative Shields? Aye. Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Wisnet? Aye. Chair Barker? Aye. Motion carries. I'll care. I don't care. It doesn't matter. I'll care. Representative Wisnet can carry that. No further business before the committee today. Meeting adjourned.